Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Eric Kingfisher. Eric's from the Jefferson Land Trust, where he's the stewardship director. And you may ask, well, what is that? Well, when the land trust helps in perpetuity protect land, the stewardship program at the land trust then ensures that the protections are actually honored over time. So they're real. So what Eric does is he oversees the strategy and the direction for that program. So part of his work is working directly with landowners, volunteers, other partners, and they monitor, protect, and restore properties that are protected through conservation easements. Eric is a multi-talented guy. In addition, he's one of the founders and leaders of the Land Trust, exceedingly popular, Tied Lands to Timberline course. It's an adult natural history course. And the exciting thing this spring is that it's operating in person after a 2-year hiatus due to the pandemic. And then one last thing about Eric. On the Jefferson Land Trust website, describes him as a really great dad, pretty good natural, and an awesome musician. Well, I can't speak to two of those qualities, but I mean, I'm a fan of Eric's. I think he is an absolutely terrific naturalist and teacher. So welcome, Eric.
Thanks, Nan. That was a great introduction.
We'll be talking about climate resiliency on the North Olympic Peninsula, where we're all thinking about the summers are going to be longer and drier, and the winters are going to be warmer and wetter. And of course, that will pose challenges and threats to our farms and forests and wildlife habitats. So what we're going to do with Eric is explore some work that the Land Trust has done in trying to understand those effects and to figure out how to do conservation in this sort of changing time and do conservation in a way that's sort of strategically targeted to benefit both sort of ecological and human communities. But of course, before we get into that, as always, let's hear that mystery sound. Well, I'm going to give you no hints on this one, other than I'm sure you've heard it around town. So, Eric, just to give us a real quick background, I mentioned a couple of things that we will see here on the North Olympic Peninsula as changes in our climate are starting to impact this area. So in addition to my reference to longer and drier summers and warmer and wetter winters, what kinds of things do we expect to see here?
No, thanks so much, Nan. And I'm glad you're choosing this topic for Nature Now. There's so much to think about and consider on the subject, obviously. So as you indicated, the Land Trust has been doing a lot of work to look into trying to understand what climate change is going to mean for the things that we really care about in this particular part of the world, you know, the Olympic Peninsula. So I can share what some of the fundamentals of what we've learned about the changes that are really predictable and what are informing how we're approaching conservation and how that's affecting our conservation planning here at the Land Trust. So as you know, human activities and associated carbon pollution have already led to noticeable changes in our climate and our ecosystems. And we know that more changes are coming. They're inevitable. They're not, you know, even if we change course right now as a humanity and carbon pollution, we're going to continue to see a lot of changes. So there are a number of efforts underway to understand and measure and map these changes. And so when we look at global climate change models and we look at national climate change models and then regional climate change models, we can learn a lot about some of the predictable changes coming. And those include things like reduction of summer river and stream flows So as you can imagine, the hydrology is going to change in our aquatic systems. And there's been some really great work.
It directly affects even things like the fish and salmon passage and
As you can imagine,
of our aquatic systems.
Exactly. Right. So if it's going to be just a reduction of summer river and stream flows, what does that mean for the aquatic wildlife, let's say? Or what does that mean for the humans that rely on that in the summer as well? What does it mean for agriculture? Those kind of questions are really important things to try and understand and start to plan around and plan for. So there's been some really good work done by the U.S. Forest Service Rocky Mountain Research Station to use a what's called a variable infiltration capacity model to produce some predictions of stream flows in the United States. And in East Jefferson County, we can expect to see anywhere from about something like 1% reduction in summer stream flows for some of our lowland creeks. So there's not going to be a huge change in the flow rates, we don't think, when we look at these models, looking at up to like 2040. But there's going to be presumably or predictably about somewhere over 40% reduction in summer stream flows for some of our rivers. And that's just based on the different hydrology and where they're getting their water by 2040. So that's coming up around the corner. We're going to see like a 40% reduction in some places in terms of summer river and stream flows. And then we're going to see things like increase in winter river stream flows. So if it's lower in the summer due to the changes in the climate, we're also going to see an increase in winter stream flows. So similarly, some of these winter stream flows really may not change much in the lowland streams, but some of the upper headwaters of some of our rivers are going to see some really dramatic changes, some over 300% increase in winter river and stream flows by 2040. So that's all around the corner. There's also things like increased stream temperature we can predict. So stream temperatures are going to go up everywhere, including Chimicum Creek, where it goes through Chimicum. In a place, and we're thinking it's looking like the models are suggesting temperatures may increase by over 1.4 degrees Celsius by 2040. And so all the implications of all these things, there's lots of different implications for these things, but these are just some of the things that are being predicted by the best available science. And as you can imagine, with warmer, wetter winters, we're going to see a diminished snowpack. If you're not going to have warmer temperatures, and it's going to come down as rain and not snow. It might be more precipitation, but it's going to come down as rain than snow. And so it's not going to hold in the mountains as much. It's going to run right off into those rivers. That's part of why we're seeing those predictable larger increases in winter stream flows,
which really would have an impact on sort of water availability all year long.
Yeah, which again, it correlates to those summer, reduced summer stream flows. Yeah.
And of course, I think we're already beginning to see it in the human community. We're seeing, I think the phrase is now climate refugees, humans who are deciding to move to areas that are now more comfortable, I guess, to live in than some areas, other areas of the country. Anecdotally, I look around my neighborhood and the people who moved in have almost all been from the deep Southwest. Folks coming for cooler temperatures. When the land trust started approaching this question, the question of resiliency, I know you were talking a lot about, but it's interesting to me, the word resiliency has become quite in fashion over the last, numbers of years. And we see it used for just a huge range of circumstances. I'm, thinking about on the personal level, bouncing back up when you fall down, or, at a national level. And I think about the courage of citizens of a country under attack from a foreign power. We talk about resiliency of Ukraine, for instance. And we talk about the resiliency of communities to respond to natural disasters. And, there are even advertisements on the TV about resiliency as a fund investment strategy. So lots of people use that word a lot of different ways. But in the context of your world, where we're thinking about the protection and conservation of farms and forests and wildlife habitats and the communities, human communities that depend upon them, how are you using the word resiliency and what does it mean to you?
Great. Yeah, that's important to kind of have a common narrative around that. I think there's a lot to talk about just with the concept of resilience and resiliency. I think that when I use that word in the context of conservation and stewardship, what we're talking about is the ability of these places that we're helping protect, these ecosystems, these places, and however they're functioning, whether they're working forest, working farm, habitat, property, wetland, their ability to recover after some sort of impact one way or another. So whether it's like an extreme heat event or some sort of drought or some sort of insect infestation or major storm or something like that, what's their ability to rebound from that and maintain their vigor and health and integrity as an ecological system or as a functional property? Mm-hmm. And so we know that places that are in, you know, current state of well-being and health, and they've got a lot of biodiversity, let's say in a forest that's nicely distributed with different species of trees and also has different age classes of trees, so you have structural diversity as well as biodiversity in the forest. That's a place that's going to have more resilience than a forest that is, say, one species or mostly one mm-hmm. species and all the same age, for example, when it comes to things like a fire or some sort of wind events or something like that. That system is going to be able to rebound better. It's going to be more resilient in response to those impacts that are going to be coming and that are sometimes historically part of the system, but they may be coming more often mm-hmm. with the way things are going with the climate change. And it's also helpful when thinking about resilience to think about resistance as well. I mean, we ultimately want these places to be able to resist some of the impacts of changing climate that are going to be coming more often. So the first line of defense is just to resist the changes and not necessarily be severely impacted in the first place. So can we set things up in a way that they're going to be able to resist these impacts and these threats to their integrity? And then if they are otherwise compromised by that, then they're able to bounce back. And then if they're not able to bounce back, then what? What is it going to take to allow that property to function in a way that's beneficial to the system now and the future system that is coming?
So my thinking now is we're getting sort of progressively more site-specific or more area-specific. From the land trust perspective, in sort of the things that you do and the mission that drives you, talk a bit about why it's important to actually determine where the potentially resilient areas, and you mentioned the resistant areas, are. Why is that important to the land trust?
That's a great question, because I think it's important to think of, for all of us to be thinking about the future a lot when it comes to the land base that we have here. We are in a incredible time, and conservation historically in America certainly has really trended towards trying to help resist change and maintain historic or current conditions. And in some senses, that's going to be impossible. I mean, think of something like sea level rise, and it's going to be impossible. So that's not really, I mean, yes, there's a lot of historic and current conditions that are very, very valuable to the overall well-being of our community and the plants and animals and the ecosystem. But the real challenge for us all is to be thinking about the future scenario when we're going to be seeing temperatures that are higher in the summer, drier summers, warmer, winter is wetter, winter is more extreme. Weather events, heat events, storm events. And what is that going to mean for these places? Well, why are we thinking about it in the sense of conservation is we're doing this work of permanent land conservation with a very clear focus on perpetuity. We're not looking at trying to protect places for 10 years or 30 years or even 100 years. We're looking at perpetuity. We're looking at helping the community protect places and manage and steward places for future generations, really. And when we think about those future generations and the kind of climate conditions that are predicted to be here, then we have to be prepared to help these places maintain themselves and adapt to over time as those climate changes come to pass. And so that's I think, a really important part of what our conservation planning is focused on now. When we look at a landscape, we can see what's there now, and we know there's so much there that's very important, and there's still tons to do to help protect some of the function of our watersheds through permanent land conservation. And at the same time, the kinds of climate change that we're going to experience here, there's also recognition that some of these places are going to do a lot better than other places. Some places are going to be able to adapt and be more resilient than other places on the map. So we can use the best available science and the models that are available to start to differentiate or distinguish, I guess, which places are going to have that kind of feature that may allow for the most retention of a certain ecological function over time, or whether the ecological function or other function like farmland values, or even working forest land values, or even values that benefit the community in other ways.
So I know that the Jefferson Land Trust and the North Olympic Land Trust, with the support of a number of other important partners, recently did a resilience study, climate resilience study for Clallam County and Jefferson County. Talk to me a bit about that, because I'm seeing that sort of progressively getting to the point of trying to find information that will influence your specific decisions as you work on the ground. So what were the key basic goals of this study and the basic questions that you were asking?
That's helpful. Yeah, it's a big project that we undertook, and exactly, we had a lot of support and partners to launch into this important study. It's really a spatial analysis that we conducted. And well, first of all, we reached out to the Land Trust Alliance, which is a national land trust association, essentially, who had secured some funding from a number of different philanthropic sources to help land trusts do some conservation planning around climate resilience. And it was a competitive grant, and we were awarded that grant in partnership really with the North Olympic Land Trust. We both applied with this intention of collaborating and working together on a study, a spatial analysis of the North Olympic Peninsula, the areas that we are working within, to try to answer some important questions. And we also had some support from the Sustainable Paths Foundation, which was great to help make all that happen. We worked with a GIS consulting firm called Core GIS and laid it all out to try and get some of these questions answered. So we work as a land trust in a lot of different ways. We achieve this mission of helping the community preserve open space, working lands and habitat forever. And when we look at our conservation plan itself, which is available online for anybody who's interested, it's a really wonderful thing to take a look at if you're interested in like the real trajectory and intentions of Jefferson Land Trust, is to look at the it's a 100-year conservation plan. It's sort of a strategic document to help outline the direction we are going as a community through the land trust. And that plan, which was published in 2010, outlines the work of the land trust in what I call four pillars of work. We work in habitat and biodiversity protection. We work in working forest protection. We work in working farm protection. We also work with what we call community conservation. So four main pillars of work that we do to achieve the mission of the land trust. And that all has different implications, or the climate change has different implications for all of those different pillars, or those different ways in which the land trust achieves its mission. So with all of those, with habitat biodiversity probably being the most pronounced part of that work, at least in the overall timeline of the land trust, we're asking things like, well, where are those lands? Can we find and identify those lands and features that are most likely retain their ecological integrity and those features that support the existing and migrating biodiversity present now and that's predicted to be here? Where are those places that are going to be?
So were you able to actually map that?
Essentially, yes. We were able to identify the places, you know, so that's a complicated question. So we used several different data sources to try and answer that question. We brought up a lot of different data and we looked at it in lots of different ways and we overlaid it in lots of different ways. And we did identify several places that appear to have a kind of high resilience index. They have high levels of critical habitat and they have high levels of topoclimatic diversity and they have a lot of high levels of resilience. And so there's a map that we produced that is a sort of the results of this analysis that say, okay, there's lots of different kinds of property. There's lots of different kind of land out there, lots of different kind of land conditions out there. And based on the best available science, based on all this data, these polygons here seem to be the ones that are going to be able to retain their resilient condition over time better than some of these other places. And
can you give us like an example of one or two of those especially resilient areas?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, you know, in the analysis, I think the map is published on our website too. If you look at the land study, this land resilience study on our website, there should be a map link in there that shows where some of these polygons really landed for us. And what that means is that we're focusing our attention a little bit more on those. It's not the answer for everything we're going to do from the future. It's just that now we know, according to this analysis that we've done, the best available science, that there are some areas that have sort of premium resilience features and factors that and conditions that are very important to protect for those future generations. Because if those were to be developed or exploited or converted, then there's that's a lot less opportunity for the habitat and the biodiversity that we currently have here and the future biodiversity to thrive, according to the best available science. And so the areas that have popped up on there, there's several different areas within East Jefferson County, especially that have particularly high resilience values and for habitat and biodiversity. And that includes everything, you know, areas like there's a sort of a corridor between Discovery Bay and Quilcene Bay, really along those kind of in that 101 corridor area, that Leland watershed and a little Quilcene watershed. Look, like that popped up kind of interestingly for us as a priority area. There's places like down in the kind of Thorndike watershed, which is mostly unfragmented land, unfragmented by development, that has shown up as having a lot of high biodiversity and habitat potential and resilience features.
We have stopped at the point where if someone is interested, they know there are maps out there, how can they access it? So tell us again how somebody who's listening to this and is curious enough to look at the various maps from your study, how do they do that?
Okay, great. So the study that we did, the analysis that we did generate what essentially kind of a roll-up map. We called it a roll-up map because it's a lot of different data that we rolled up into this map of priority opportunity areas, places that represent an opportunity, a conservation opportunities for permanent protection that will help benefit future generations if they can be protected and prevented from conversion and exploitation. And the map itself is one thing, but there's a lot more that goes into that resilience study. So we've loaded a bunch of stuff on our website. Our website for Jefferson Land Trust is saveland.org, so SAVELAND.org. And then there's a search button or a search bar. You can add in land resilience study, and it'll pop up to this webpage with a number of links and some information about this particular conservation planning endeavor that we took with CoreGIS, and then also in partnership with the Northumbric Land Trust. They also generated a similar map and similar answers to their questions.
We just run up against the problem of radio. It's like, you can't see this stuff.
Yes, right. No,
so
yeah,
go to
for
the
sure.
website. Yeah, I actually want to go look because I'm real curious about some places too myself. But we are running out of time and we need to quickly listen to that mystery sound again. Well, that was Eric's namesake bird, the belted kingfisher. And many of you know kingfishers can be found during almost any season here on the Olympic Peninsula. They're always near water, whether it's lakes, streams, rivers, or along the coast. And you can often really first notice the belted kingfisher as it's flying over the water and it's screaming that wild rattling call. You can also spot them on snags or pilings or hovering over the water just before it's going to plunge headfirst into the water to grab its meal. I kind of sometimes think of them as birds with great attitudes. And Eric, I have to ask, is there a brief story behind your last name?
Yeah, I mean, it's not exactly a brief story, but I can make it brief. It's our last name, my wife and I decided to change our name as we start a family. And so we spent a couple of years actually talking and thinking about what we might want to do as a, as we got engaged and we got married and determined what we really want to do with our last name, recognizing there's conventional ways and there's unconventional ways to do all this. And our circumstance and our reality led us to the decision to actually come up with a new name, a new family name for ourselves. And with the blessing of our own families, they thought that was great. So we came up with a new name and we jumped around a lot of different ideas, but Kingfishers have always been sort of a symbol in our relationship. Mm-hmm. And it really suits us in for a lot of different reasons. So we decided to give it a try and try it on and decided that was a really good fit. So we legally changed our name and now our children both have Kingfisher as their last name. And we're all
that's great. That's great. Well, we've come to the end of Nature Now for this week. I hope everyone has enjoyed it. Ending music today is a song called Resilience by Abby Batinas. And it's a virtual recording by the Cleveland Chamber Choir done via Zoom, as we are still via Zoom. They recorded it in April of 2020. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Resilience. We are strong, shoulder to shoulder, keep moving on. Resilience, make a new plan, stand up again and say, yes, we can.
Resilience, we are strong, shoulder to shoulder, keep moving on. Resilience, make a new plan, stand up again and say, yes, we can. Resilience, we are strong, shoulder to shoulder, keep moving on. Resilience, make a new plan, stand up again and say, yes, we can. Resilience, we are strong, shoulder to shoulder, keep moving on.
Dungeness River Nature Center is pleased to support KPTZ programming like Nature Now. In memory of Dee and Beverly Swearingen, who taught their children and grandchildren the love and stewardship of nature, Dungeness River Nature Center, teaching generations about nature on the Olympic Peninsula at Railroad Bridge Park in Squim. More at DungenessRiverCenter.org.